Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Andy Neal. He is a music writer, researcher, and historian, and we're talking about his latest book, Ready, Steady, Go. The Weekend Starts Here. Andy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
This is a monster book. It weighs 6 pounds. It's a huge tome. I got to ask you about putting this book together. It looks like there's years and years of work put into this book. Talk to me about it. It's even coming up with the idea of to finally do an overview book of Ready, Steady, Go.
Well, yes, it was quite an achievement in terms of the time it took and the amount of research it took and lots of interviews and lots of research, spending hours in libraries and tracking down people connected with the show. Of course, I started this book way back in 2003. It followed on the heels of a book I'd written on The Who. And as part of that particular book, I'd interviewed Ready, Steady, Go's original producer, Vicky Wickham, and also the director, Michael Lindsay Hogg. And after I'd finished The Who book, I thought, well, what is then, you know, what hasn't been done? What subject is worth documenting that hasn't been done before and something that appeals to me but also has a sort of wider resonance? And that's when I came up with the idea to document the show, because even though it's sort of pretty much unknown in America, it was very much a very important part of the mid-60s here in Britain. And it sort of got sort of talked about in various biographies and what have you about the 1960s, but only in passing. It never really warranted more than, say, a few paragraphs about its influence and who was on it and what have you. So I just felt that it needed to be documented properly. And so I set to work in 2003, and we finally got past the finish line in 2019.
It's amazing. I mean, I had heard of the show and I had seen stuff on YouTube. Actually, my first exposure to the idea that the show existed was the Gen X song, Ready, Steady, Go. And I had no idea what they were singing about. But my passion has always been, because I lived through the era, the British rock music of that era. And the photography alone in this book is worth the price of admission. I mean, talk to me about getting all those photographs of behind the scenes and when the show was on. It has to have been a long journey.
Yes. It comes back into what I was saying about all the work involved in research, and that included the photographic images, because the one saving grace for actually collecting everything together was that the main photographic agencies here in England, and also in various private collections, Ready, Steady, Go was so popular that every Friday, most of the top photographers that were working for the press or magazines or, you know, any even foreign press would come to the television studios every Friday and were guaranteed of getting great photographs of whichever star was on. So you might see one photograph that was published at the time, but if you did a bit of digging, you'd find that there was a whole roll of about 24 shots, not just of that particular group or artist, but some of the other groups and artists that were on the same show that had never been published before. So it was a veritable goldmine once you started to uncover various things. And also a lot of, you know, photographers that weren't affiliated to any newspaper or magazine would get press passes and come down there and take some shots. And, you find that I found there were some fantastic shots that had never been published, which is the private individuals that I managed to track down by hook or by crook, you know. So it was quite a process involved there, too.
And it's amazing the interviews you got for the show, too, including by rock stars that appeared early on. Like Mick Jagger wrote, there's a whole long piece about Mick Jagger talking about the show.
That's right. Well, all of the people, all of the A-listers, if you want to call them that, you know, and everybody has a special place in their memory for Ready, Steady, Go.
Yeah, yeah.
Because especially with the Rolling Stones, as using them as an example, you know, they were unknown.
Well, this was only their second TV appearance, wasn't it? The first one was just couple of months before.
That's right. A month before on Thank You Lucky Stars, which was a program on a rival network that was taped and shown the following week. And that came from Birmingham. And, you know, they'd been on that first. They were booked onto that first. But Ready, Steady, Go, when they did the first show and they, you know, the team behind the show, Vicky Wickham and Frances Hitching, had actually been out to see the band perform at the Crawdaddy Club in Richmond, the legendary residency they had in the club where they pretty much made their name. And so, but they were still pretty much unknown outside of London, and they just had their first record released. And at that point, Ready, Steady, Go was still only shown mainly in the London area. But the thing with Ready, Steady, Go that appealed to the Stones is that the production, the people behind it, were relatively the same age as the band, and they related to them a lot more closely than other shows that they were on. And also, Ready, Steady, Go gave them and all the other acts that became sort of integral to the show to carte blanche to do what they wanted within reason. You know, they could do the A side, the hit side of the single, but also the B side, or they could do a track off an EP, or they could even, show eventually went live, play stuff in their stage act that they wouldn't necessarily record.
Now, the show had a relatively short run, just 63 to 66, but the impact that the show had on Britain and Europe was outsized. I mean, it was a huge impact. It was a trend-setting show.
It was, yes. It was pretty much, because it was a London show and it was being beamed every week, every Friday night from the heart of London, it was sort of like, in a way, it was like holding up a mirror to what was happening in London at the time. You know, it was just one of those happy accidents that Ready, Steady, Go came along at the time that there was this tremendous social change happening in the country, and particularly in London and the capital, you know, where all the trends tended to emerge from. And so if you were a kid living in the suburbia or living in the provinces or, you know, way up in Scotland, you know, once your TV station took the show, I mean, if you were a young teenager wondering, you know, well, what are the latest dances, what's happening in the world of fashion, when's the next record going to be out? It was almost like a required viewing to find out.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
And Ready, Steady, Go was very much its raison d'etre, in a way, was to sort of be at the cutting edge of all that.
Now, what was on in Britain, what was on television before Ready, Steady, Go that dealt with anything like youth music?
Well, there'd been, in the first chapter of the book, which is called Before the Weekend Started, I sort of summarize.
It didn't look like there was much.
No, there was quite a few shows, but they were very much run on very conventional, you know, lines that had been mapped out before. You know, for example, Thank You Lucky Stars, which we mentioned earlier, that was a good example of how pop music was sort of presented at that point. It was usually helmed by somebody who had a proven track record as a disc jockey on the radio. So they were brought before the cameras to sort of be the safe pair of hands to link and introduce all the acts. But when the acts would come on, you would get sort of like proven winners. So as we know, in that era before the Beatles, it wasn't that exciting in terms of like homegrown acts. So you'd get somebody like, you know, Billy Fury or, you know, a lot of these sort of how you guys had the Frankies and the Bobbies, you know, in the 60s and early 60s in the States, we got a lot of these sort of similar, almost sort of middle of the road.
There were none of the acts that were going to be like surprising or cutting edge like the Stones were in that day.
That's right. But I mean, there was still some good stuff. I mean, you still had your Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, and your, you know, people like that would appear. But generally, they were, you know, they were put onto a fairly standard television set with a few props. You know, there might be some things hanging down from the ceiling, or, you know, like a trellis or something in the background. And they would say, okay, here's your spot marked with an X when you're singing your song, walk from here to there, and the camera will follow you. And that was about as adventurous as it got, you know.
Well, who's that? Okay, we got so much ground to cover. Whose idea was it for Ready, Steady, Go, and how did they get it on the air?
Well, the idea for the show, and for all this sort of credit, must really be put at the door of a guy called Elkin Allen. Now, Elkin Allen was a journalist. He'd started in media, like as a print journalist, writing for newspapers and magazines. But as television took off in Britain in the 50s, and you know, commercial television started in the mid 50s here, he was very much curious and very much spellbound by how television was developing in Britain, and he wanted to be a part of that. So he sort of started off when he came to work for the station that made Ready, Steady, Go, a London company called Associated Rediffusion. He started off on Current Affairs. You know, he was a journalist, so he was like the editor of a weekly Current Affairs show. And then he'd spent some time on that, and he was sort of like producing a lot of these shows and commissioning them. And then quite unexpectedly, the head of programming made him the head of Light Entertainment a year before Ready, Steady, Go started. So he sort of came to the world of, like, you know, Light Entertainment totally, you know, it was something that he'd never done. So in some ways, he was, in that sort of unconventional way, he was perfect for commissioning something like Ready, Steady, Go, because he had no real idea of how it should run. But he because he sort of came from a quite unorthodox background, he was quite prepared to let his production team, who were untried like him, to run the show. So you've got him to thank for commissioning the show on the one hand, but also for letting the lunatics take over the asylum, if you like.
And does talk about the show. From the get-go, it was a show about the music, about fashion, about the records that were coming out, and there was always this sort of youthful thing. It became, first of all, it was on Friday night. The Weekend starts here. That was their catchphrase.
That's right. Well, actually, you say it started off like with fashion and dancing. In actual fact, it didn't to start with. It was replacing a program in the same time slot that was sort of a bit like I guess you have them over there. We have them still here in Britain, where a look at what's happening this week, what's happening in your area this week. It was like what we call a news magazine program, and it was, the ratings weren't that great, and the controller of the station was looking at ways to sort of revitalize that particular time slot. And so when Ready, Steady, Go first started, it still sort of had the remains of that sort of thing of where, oh, we're going to be telling you about what theatre, what plays have started in London and the West End, and what cinema, you know, what new like shows of what new films are coming in from Hollywood and what have you. And then we'll have a group, you know, so it was sort of a bit of a, you know, what do you call it, mixed media presentation. But Elkin Allen was very shrewd, and to his credit, let the music element and the thing that appealed to the younger set basically take over the whole program. And so then eventually you got the things that appealed more to teenagers, and that of course is when he had the masterstroke of getting in young presenters in the form of Kathy McGowan for a brief time Michael Aldred, and that's when the show really took off.
Let's talk about Kathy McGowan, because she became like the muse of the mod. I mean, she became an incredible figure through that show.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she was perfect for the show because, and she was perfect for the mood of the show because she was just like a teenage girl who tuned in every week or was in the audience, you know, watching the pop stars, catching up on the fashion tips, you know, finding out about the dances. So she was sort of cut from the same cloth as the audience, and it was just, perfect, because we touched upon the shows that had come before Ready, Steady, Go. If you look at them, they were all hosted by older figures sort of either professionals or, you know, they were sort of not of the target age group. They were sort of like almost like your dad hosting the show. And Ready, Steady, Go still had that with a guy called Keith Fordyce, who was a well-respected name in British broadcasting. He'd had lots of experience. So he was still there to keep an eye on, you know, make sure that, the train stayed on the tracks, as it were. And, you know, because both Kathy and Michael had no previous experience before the camera. And so they were sort of, they were quite nervous and quite often tongue-tied and would fumble the introductions and forget the group's names or forget the name of the record. So, you know, there had to be an authority figure there to still make sure it ran smoothly. But it soon became apparent that the reason the ratings were going up through the roof is because they had these young kids who were just like them, and that's what people were tuning in to see.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Andy Neal. He's a music writer, researcher, and historian, and we're talking about his latest book. It is a tome. It is an amazing book. Ready, steady, go. The weekend starts here. Andy, the dancers were really critical and essential for the show. Where did the dancers come from?
The dancers were there right from the very start, from the pilot. And although it was quite a happy accident how they came to be such a preeminent part of the program, they'd shot a pilot for the show. They were just curious to see, you know, how it would work. And dancers were brought in. Well, actually, they weren't dancers. They were just part of the typical audience bust in for a pilot, and they were all sitting in chairs on the studio floor. And the first group to be booked for the show that appeared in the pilot were Brian Paul and the Tremolos, who I don't think were that big in the States, but they were very big here for a brief time in 1963-64. So they were the first band on. And they basically mimed to their current single. I think it was a cover of Twist and Shout. And everybody got up out of their seats and started to dance. And so
just spontaneously dancing.
Yeah. They just got up, and they were taping it like a normal show. So there was a break where they would go into the commercials, and Elkin Allen went up to his children who'd come along to sort of give their critical view, because he was very much aware of it was a show aimed at young kids, so he wanted their feedback, and Elkin's son said, why don't you get rid of the chairs, because everybody wants to dance. And so he said, okay, I totally overlooked that. So before they started taping the second half of the show, all the chairs were cleared out, and Brian Paul came back to do another song in the second half of the show, and again everybody got up and danced, and it was just hit him between the eyes that this is the key to the show, that it should be a bare studio, but with enough space for, say, 150 kids to cram into this basement studio and dance to and get up close to the stars. So it was almost another thing that he was aiming to do, was to break down the barrier between performer and audience.
Right.
And that's why when you see the clips that still survive of Ready, Steady, Go, you'll see somebody like, Dusty Springfield or whoever it may be, singing surrounded by the kids. I mean, they're literally right up nose to nose with her.
Now, there's a theme music, and I never knew this. There's so much in this book I never knew before. The theme music was written by Manfred Mann?
Correct, yes.
5-4-3-2-1.
5-4-3-2-1, yes. They'd been themed to the show before. I mean, most notably Wipeout by the Safaris, which they used as the theme music. But then Elkin Allen came up with the idea of, why don't we get our own signature tune, that's, readily identified to the show. And so he commissioned it. And he and the producer, Francis Hitching, had been to see Manfred Mann at the Marquee because, Manfred Mann, we tend to look at them now as sort of like a pop group, with all their hits, Do Our Diddy Diddy and what have you. They're, at least three of the guys in the band were serious jazz musicians. So, they could play, they were pretty good musicians, and they were playing at a club in London here that's quite famous, the Marquee Club. And so they were approached after they'd played at the Marquee and said, listen, can you come up with a song? It was almost like writing for a television commercial. It needs to be, 12 bars of instrumental, then a catchphrase, and then, a chorus. And so they went away and wrote it. It wasn't that difficult, but as soon as it was apply to the show. It was like, you know, the rallying call, you know, this was what the kids were waiting for. It was like the, you know, this was the signature tune to the, not only the show, but also the weekend starting. But it's been a bit of a misconception that everybody thinks that that was the theme tune all throughout the 3 years the show was on the air. It wasn't. They frequently updated the theme, you know, every couple of months or so. And but
didn't they also update the title sequences, the intro sequence?
Oh, yes, all the time.
Yeah,
all the time. These are sort of the misconceptions that I really wanted to clear up in the book, because everyone just thinks that it was one theme, one sort of, like, you know, title sequence all the way through. It wasn't. I mean, this is another thing where Ready, Steady, Go try to stay ahead of the pack. They had a brilliant art and graphics department, and every, you know, 6 weeks or so, it was like, we need a new title sequence. And these guys who are interviewed in the book, you know, to say that we would, like, every week come up with new ideas and graphics to introduce the show. And you see some of them, they were quite ahead of their time.
Well, and there were also these collages, and I forget the artist that did them. They were absolutely fascinating.
A guy called Nicholas Ferguson.
Do they still exist?
Yeah. No, he in the book, Nicholas says that, you know, nobody had any thought to tomorrow and whether these things would have any sort of longevity in terms of cultural value. And, you know, people would come to him after, you know, the show had gone off the air saying, oh, I really love that collage, you know, what's going to happen to it? And he says, oh, just take it. You know, we'll probably throw it away. So he gave so many of them away. And
oh my God.
What you see in the book, what you see reproduced in the book is pretty much what's left.
Oh, no. Now, there's so many stories, and we're going to run out of time. There's a weird story when the Ronettes came from America with Phil Spector, and he was the amateur DJ. Do you remember? Yes. Do you remember that story? I can't believe he put everybody through the ringer with that.
Well, that's Phil Spector for you. Phil Spector put everybody through the ringer. he had come to London. To basically, you know, he was sort of keeping an eye on the Ronettes, because by that point, of course, he started his relationship with Ronnie Spector, or Ronnie Bennett, as she was then. And so they were on tour with the Stones. They were doing a package tour around Britain with the Stones, and they appeared on Ready, Steady, Go. But then a few weeks later, Phil was invited back to actually... Phil was actually invited to be the amateur DJ, as you say, and he had specifically wanted Major Lance's record, which was quite a popular record in the clubs, but it was quite an obscure record. I don't think it had even been released in Britain at that point. I think the only copy available might have been an American import. I'm not 100% sure on that. But anyway, regardless, Phil had insisted, and he was quite adamant that that was the record he wanted. And the poor show researcher had been ringing around and could not find this record. So the director had sort of tactfully asked if he would consider choosing another record, but Phil, being Phil, said, no, that's the record I want. That's the record I want played. And literally, I think just minutes before the show went on air, they managed to find a copy of the record.
Oh, my God.
It all went ahead fine, but yeah. Phil Spector was an example of the sort of curveballs that were thrown on the show. Being a live show, it wasn't taped. You know, you could, all sorts of things, all sorts of calamities could happen. And that was an example of the sort of things that they had to be prepared for.
And of course, the Beatles appeared.
Yes.
Now,
quite early on.
Quite early on in their career. And there's some great photographs of them in the book. It sounded like John was a bit of a handful.
Well, again, it's the same thing we talked about with Spector.
Yeah.
It was the case of, you know, the whole live element could produce unexpected results. And, you know, John was already known as a bit of a, you know, quick-witted character. He had to keep up with his mind. It could go anywhere. And that's why Dusty Springfield was quite taken aback when she asked, you know, quite innocently, are these what these little cute looking marks are? And John Lennon just butted in, as he would, no, they're scabs. Let me see your scabs. So you couldn't,
when I read that in the book, I couldn't believe he said
that. Yeah, no, you couldn't. And that actually still survives. You can probably see it on YouTube. That was live. They couldn't cut that. You know, in the grand scheme of things, it wasn't that offensive, but it was quite, it was quite a shock tactic for television in 1963 in Britain.
There is, at the end of this massive book, there are 4 pages of appearance indexes, which is closely, smallly typed if you want to know the number of acts that have appeared on Ready, Steady, Go.
When they appeared.
Oh, yeah. My God.
So, I did that because I felt like, if you just wanted to know how many times.
Yeah, yeah.
Say,
Dion
appeared on the show. You can add it up.
I love details there. Like that. Yeah. Why did we're almost out of time. Why did the show end?
It was losing ratings. And like with any show, it has its moment, and then you either start to get stuck in a rut and repeat yourself, or other shows come along that are ratings winners, and you're in the same time slot, you're competing against other things, and I just think that it had been on the air for about 2 years by that point, and the ratings were starting to slip. And also, the irony is that by making the show into a live show, and making every artist and performer actually perform live, it was quite a bold move, a revolutionary move in a way. And it was quite exciting, but at the same time, television viewers, notoriously conservative by nature, and a lot of them were saying, Ready, Steady, Go's gone live now. It doesn't, the music doesn't sound the same. I want to hear the sound that I'm going to be buying on a record. I don't want to hear the Who play.
Oh no.
I can't explain live. I want to hear it as it was on the radio. And so, you were starting to get people complaining about it in a way. And Top of the Pop stole a march on it because,
yep.
It was more, it ran to a much more safer formula where the artists were just simply mimed to their record. And it was pretty much a chart-bound show.
That's right.
They were only featuring what was in the charts. Whereas Ready, Steady, Go would take a chance by putting somebody like, Wilson Pickett on, James Brown.
Yep,
and there's a whole special devoted to James Brown. There's a whole chapter in how that really ruffled a lot of feathers. And so we look back on it now and we sort of marvel at how forward-thinking they were in putting these great artists on. But in actual fact, it worked against them.
We're completely out of time, and we have honestly only scratched the surface of this book. This is a must-have if you're a person who is interested in rock music at that time. My guest tonight has been Andy Neal, music writer, researcher, and historian. And we've been talking about his latest book, Ready, Steady, Go, The Weekend Starts Here. It is fantastic. Andy, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
And a pleasure talking to you, Mark. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.